Good morning. My name is Michael McCusker. I begin today's program with an article written for the New York Times by Michael Kazin, who is a co-editor of Dissent and a history professor at Georgetown University. He is a friend from a long time ago, during an earlier period of tumult, the anti-Vietnam War riots of Chicago and Portland, and back when he was a student at Portland State University. America's Never-Ending Culture War by Michael Kazin. On the evening of August 26, 1968, I was arrested on a street corner in Chicago for a dubious crime, protesting a political event. This was, of course, the Democratic National Convention, which was about to nominate as its presidential candidate Hubert Humphrey, the vice president, who had staunchly supported the decision to send 500,000 troops to pursue a deeply immoral and doomed mission in Vietnam. I joined hundreds of others in jail that night. Many of us at the time felt we had a duty to oppose the war, and we certainly felt the historical weight of that moment. But I don't think any of us expected that the conflict, not just over the war, but over two visions for American society, would still be raging half a century later. The day I was released, a confrontation between helmeted police and nonviolent demonstrators erupted in front of the Hilton Hotel in downtown Chicago. It was shown live on television for a full 17 minutes. Viewers saw police brutally attacking men and women with mace and clubs. The video, replayed over the next few days, shocked and angered millions who opposed the war. But pollsters soon found that twice as many Americans sided with the police as sided with the protesters. Whatever their views on the intervention in Indochina, a majority seemed to believe that the young, allegedly unpatriotic troublemakers had it coming. Mayor Richard Daley thundered in defense of his men in blue that his administration and the people of Chicago, quote, would never permit a lawless, violent group of terrorists to menace the lives of millions of people, destroy the purpose of a national public convention, and take over the streets. In many ways, the civil war fought out in Mayor Daley's city that summer has never really ended. The ugly 2016 campaign and Donald Trump's embattled administration are only the latest episodes in a long conflict fought on several fronts, cultural, social, and political. This discord is hardly unprecedented, as journalists and some political scientists have claimed, nor has the United States recently, quote, lost a sense of common purpose and a, quote, sense of common narrative, as former Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice told CNN this spring. Not only do Americans continue to debate, often angrily, about when and how the police should use violence against unarmed civilians, liberals and leftists still battle with conservatives over most of the other big issues that roiled the nation back then: affirmative action, the right to abortion, freedom for gays and lesbians, curbs on corporate power, environmental protection, the politics of academia, and rulings by the Supreme Court that cheer one camp and infuriate the other. Of course, the identities and targets of the combatants have shifted over the years. Now it's progressives who accuse the Supreme Court of making decisions based on ideology rather than law. And who could have imagined that liberal Democrats would be defending the FBI while conservative Republicans denounce it? But the harsh divisions among Americans in 1968 have largely endured. They are rooted in profound disagreements based on culture and creeds that are impervious to compromise. If one thinks abortion is murder, or that LGBTQ people deserve every right that heterosexuals have, the very idea of finding a middle ground is abhorrent. the mutual hostility between religious conservatives and liberals and non-believers that emerged in the 1960s also fuels these seemingly irreconcilable differences. Each side is convinced it represents a majority, and a moral one at that. In addition, the alienation of rural white Americans from cosmopolitan urban dwellers has only increased since big cities became entry points of immigrants from all over the world. The family reunifications made possible by the Immigration and Nationality Act of 1965 helped create today's polyglot big cities. The absence of a stable partisan majority also keeps our domestic conflicts on a persistent burn. Richard Nixon's victory in 1968 and his landslide re-election 4 years later tore apart the New Deal coalition that had dominated national politics with barely a pause since the early 1930s. Of the 11 presidential contests from 1976 to 2016, Republicans have won 6 and Democrats 5. But on just 4 occasions has the Republican victor gained a plurality of the popular vote. Control of one or both houses of Congress has swung back and forth, too. In 1951, the eminent political scientist Samuel Lubell observed that the Democrats were like the sun, the Republicans the moon. It is within the majority party that the issues of any particular period are fought out, he explained, while the minority party shines in reflected radiance of the heat thus generated. But for the past half century, the major parties have been more akin to asteroids that occasionally collide, but whose gyrations move neither of them much closer to the center of the political solar system. Since the late 1960s, office holders have sought to gain an advantage for their side by stoking the fires of conflict. This has been a consistent habit more on the right than among liberals. Dividing the American people has been my main contribution to the national political scene, acknowledged Spiro Agnew, who served as Nixon's vice president until he resigned in disgrace in 1973. I not only plead guilty to this charge, Agnew said, but I am somewhat flattered by it. During his first term in Congress a few years later, Newt Gingrich accused Speaker of the House Tip O'Neill of placing communist propaganda, and that's a quote, in his office. Last June, Eric Trump emulated these predecessors, as well as his own father, when he told Sean Hannity on Fox that Washington Democrats are not even people. Until recently, prominent Democrats tended to avoid responding with incendiary statements of their own. Presidents Jimmy Carter, Bill Clinton, and Barack Obama all sought to win over independent voters with promises to make bipartisan agreements and transcend the bitter fights of the 1960s. Most Americans first heard of Obama when he famously declared the 2004 Democratic Convention, "There's not a liberal America and a conservative America. There is the United States of America." During Obama's presidency, his chairman of the National Endowment for the Humanities undertook a civility tour to resist what he called polarizing attitudes that, quote, can jeopardize social cohesion and even public safety. But such conciliatory rhetoric seems naive when a Republican president spews belligerence before most Americans have finished their breakfast. Progressive activists and Democrats in Congress both routinely refer to President Trump as a fascist, a tyrant, and a witting stooge of President Vladimir Putin of Russia. And after Michael Cohen incriminated Trump in court, they are also calling him a crook. Conservatives, of course, return the fire with talk of a deep state, conspiracy to overturn the will of the voters. As this year's midterm election draws closer, the language will burn even hotter. As a new leftist in 1968, I did not worry that Americans were fighting one another on the streets of Chicago and around the nation. I only wanted to figure out how my side could come out on top. Now, as a professor. I teach the virtues of empathizing with one's adversaries, of understanding why those with whom you vehemently disagree think what they think and do what they do. But as a historian, I also know that civil wars, even cultural ones, seldom end with settlements that please both sides. Until the left or the right wins a lasting victory, America will remain a society rent in two. And that was America's Never-Ending Culture War by Michael Kazin, whose most recent book is War Against War, The American Fight for Peace, 1914 to 1918. And as I said, he's a former Portlander, or at least while he went to college at PSU. And now, by E.J. Dionne Jr., Will We Ever Escape 1968? Get the thing straight once and for all. The policeman isn't there to create disorder, said Mayor Richard J. Daley in explaining the riots in the streets of his city in the summer 1968. The policeman is there to preserve disorder. Daley's verbal jumble became the butt of jokes and the source of claims inspired by Freud that the mayor had unintentionally blurted out the truth. Yet he may also have been an accidental prophet. The chaos on the streets of Chicago during the Democrats' catastrophic national convention 50 years ago last week lives on not only in memory, but also in our fractured present. In clashes played out across the country on television, Chicago's police clubbed and arrested youthful demonstrators gathered to oppose the Vietnam War. Members of the media got caught up in the melee also. The phrase fake news would have resonated with Daley, who said as much without using the words. What occurred inside the convention hall added to the vertigo. Democratic Party leaders, despite primaries showing strong support for the anti-war candidacies of Robert F. Kennedy and Eugene J. McCarthy, instead nominated Hubert H. Humphrey. He was Lyndon B. Johnson's vice president and a liberal hero, now rendered into an establishment stand-in by his refusal to break with his patron on the war. That all this was happening after a season of national horror with assassinations of the Reverend Martin Luther King Jr. and RFK created an end of times feeling. Was this what the beginning of Armageddon looked like? We have preserved the disorder of that moment in a culture war that seems to have no expiration, in divisions along the lines of class and race, in confrontations over the proper role of law enforcement, and in conflicts within a Democratic Party that never fully recovered from the wrenching schism opened by the Vietnam War. As Norman Mailer wrote in his classic, Miami and the Siege of Chicago, about the two national conventions of 1968, the grand establishment of the Democratic Party and its society life in Washington would soon be shattered. The world was shattering it. And that's a quote from Mailer. And shattered it was, a reality noticed by a governor of California elected only 2 years earlier, named Ronald Reagan. For some younger Americans, the 60s inspire nostalgia. But for more of them, in my experience, they inspire an entirely understandable impatience with the baby boom generation, my generation, that continues to play out the conflicts of its youth, even as newer voices strain to be heard in the din of old songs by Crosby, Stills, and Nash and Young, or Country Joe and the Fish. There have been many attempts to put both the 1960s and the 1980s bookends of the same struggle behind us. Barack Obama frequently expressed impatience with the chains this past latched onto our politics. He tried to honor the best of the 60s, the triumph of the civil rights movement especially, while seeking to turn our sights forward to the coming half century rather than backward. Trump's election upended Obama's efforts and brought us right back to the 60s. Here was another aging baby boomer. He was on the conservative side of most of the old fights, but not all. As Todd Gitlin, a veteran of the New Left, noted recently in an interview in The Nation, Trump embraced a particular version of male sexual liberation that was also a product of the era. Trump's 1960s playboy philosophy has been subjected to necessary and scathing criticism from women. As the author of one of the best books about the 60s, Gitlin understands just how complicated their legacy remains. There are reasons this past is still so alive to us, even to the many born long after the Battle of Grant Park in Carl Sandburg's City of the Big Shoulders. The most important was offered by Michael Kazin, who, like Gitlin, is a former New Left leader turned scholar. The simple fact, Kazin observed in the New York Times, is that the wars of the 1960s, particularly around culture, have yet to yield a winning side. If anything, Trump's rise reopened questions we had hoped were at least partially settled, especially around race. Like it or not, we need to fight these battles until they're won. But we can't keep living in the past. Doing so blinds us to the challenges of the present and leads us to squander the opportunities of the future. We have worked hard to preserve the disorders of 1968. We have to stop. And that was Will We Ever Escape 1968 by E.J. Dionne Jr., who writes about politics in a twice-weekly column and on the postpartisan blog for the Washington Post. He is also a professor at Georgetown University, where Michael Kazin teaches. And now, in regard to the tremendous forest fires in California, Oregon, Washington, and British Columbia this summer, and others yet to burn, I wish to commemorate one of the worst conflagrations recorded, the Tillamook Burn, or more accurately, the Tillamook Burns, which I wrote and quote a famous Oregon writer. The Tillamook Burns. 85 summers ago, the first Tillamook Burn started on August 14, 1933, and decimated a magnificant 400-year-old forest that had been the heart and soul of Oregon's coastal mountain range. It was one of the wildest and devastating fires ever recorded. In human reckoning, more than 13 million board feet of timber worth $275 million in 1933 was destroyed. Total acreage consumed by the fire was 411,000 acres, or more than 600 square miles of dead forest. And it was a zoological holocaust. Animals, fish, and birds perished in unbeknownst immolation. The fire was actually several fires, spawned by each other, and they burned over a distance from near Mount Hebo in the south to Seaside, and from Forest Grove almost to Wheeler, east to west. The fires burned unrestrained for 2 weeks. Only one human being was killed, a young firefighter from the Depression-era Civilian Conservation Corps. Thousands were forced to flee. In one period of 20 hours, the fire was so intense that it burned 240,000 acres, generating hurricane velocity winds that propelled it into an immense firestorm. A famous photograph shows a monstrous black explosion hurtling above a burning mountain. Oregon writer Uchia wrote in his 1984 book, Tillamook Burn Country, "On the memorable day of August 24th, the Tillamook fire literally exploded, becoming a rampaging giant that nothing could stop, traveling at high speed and destroying all in its path. Its mushroom cloud boiling more than 40,000 feet into the atmosphere, visible for hundreds of miles at sea and inland. Ash fell on ships," Lucia wrote, and likened the firestorm to an atomic bomb of a decade later. One of Oregon's most notable writers, Lucia also compared the huge cloud of smoke to the 1980 volcanic eruption of Mount St. Helens. He wrote that the fire mounted into an awesome wall of flame, exploding again and again in the tops of 400-year-old giants and creating an inferno unlike anything since the ancient eruptions of the Pacific Northwest volcanic peaks. And he wrote that 3,000 firefighters were helpless as the gigantic mushroom cloud spiraled into the sky and blotted out the sun. When the 1933 fire finally burned itself out, Oregonians looked in horror and disbelief at the destruction. Much was unrecognizable. Even familiar landmarks were completely gone, Lucia wrote. In the fire's aftermath, a new American desert was created, he wrote, stretching in all directions to the far horizons. Lucia wrote that driving through the burn was like driving through a forest of the dead. After a few years, black snags were bleached white by the summer sun and were a familiar sight to Oregonians. 6 years later, in August 1939, a fire almost the equal of its predecessor swept back over the burn and beyond, which took 4,000 firefighters more than a month to bring under control. The 1939 Holocaust mushroomed into the atmosphere much the same as 1933, Ellis Lucia wrote. The flames moved in all directions, again threatening Tillamook and smaller communities. Ash, sparks, and debris fell on northern coastal beaches. After 4 weeks, the rains came. A major tragedy of the 1939 fire was that it burned into green timber, Ellis Lucia wrote, which might have ceded denuded slopes to become a new forest. This wiped out any hope of natural reseeding. Lucia wrote that by the time the Tillamook burn exploded a third time in the hot summer of 1945, just before the end of World War II, Oregonians were convinced that the tragic region was under a six-year jinx. And it did burn one more time in 1951, which lasted 4 days and burned 20,000 acres, and it killed a firefighter. Lucia wrote that because of the continuing fires, nature never had a chance to make a comeback. Each new fire reburned the wasteland, that the Tillamook burn would never come back, at least for generations, seemed a strong possibility. For years afterward, the timber companies that were held primarily responsible for starting the fires mined the burnt dead snags in the same manner as would be done around Mount St. Helens after its May 18, 1980 eruption knocked down millions of trees. Another great Oregon writer, Stuart H. Holbrook, who had been a logger in his youth, wrote that long trains loaded with coal-black logs were rolling down off the hills. After all four fires, reforestation of the Tillamook burn was delayed until the late 1940s when most of the snags from the devastating succession of fires were logged. Thousands of volunteers and school children worked for years to replant the forest. Year after year, the planting crews moved out along the rugged slopes of the burn, often in snow and frigid temperatures, for winter was the best time for replanting, Ellis Lucia wrote. It was inglorious work. All through the 1950s and turbulent 60s, big city riots, the Vietnam War, and into the 70s. In all, Lucia wrote, 73 million seedlings were planted on 76,234 acres. Countless thousands of trees were planted by the youngsters who came from around the state. They felt very strongly about reforesting the giant burn. To be sure, he wrote, the student expeditions never got into the deep backcountry. That was left to the professionals and the helicopters. But who would ever say that youth didn't replant the Tillamook burn? The main reseeding and replanting was essentially completed in 1973-74, but it was still being done when Ellis Lucia wrote his book, Tillamook Burn Country, in 1984. And of course, the timber companies and gypo loggers are back logging the burn. Like the fires they carelessly started, there is not much in their path to stop them. The sweet smell of jobs is the scent they wear in hearings and negotiations. And as epilogue, the word firestorm, which is currently used to describe the immense forest and wildland fires of the past several years of depictable and increasingly intense global warming, was first used to express the catastrophic firebombing of German cities in World War II, in particular Hamburg in 1943 and Dresden in 1945, and the extensive immolation of Japanese cities in that same war, just prior to the use of atomic bombs on Hiroshima and Nagasaki in August 1945. In regard to American presidential matters, the 25th president, William McKinley, was assassinated today in 1901, the third U.S. president killed while in office. And today is the 261st birthday of the Marquis de Lafayette. And it is also the birthday of Jane Addams, who was born in 1860 and won the Nobel Peace Prize in 1931. This is Michael McCusker.